Welcome to Oncology Today, the use of PARP inhibitors in the management of breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Judy Garber from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a corresponding video program with Dr. Garber's slide presentation. To begin, I asked her to describe how she interprets the FDA indications for olaparib in her practice. So, first of all, everybody's thinking about adjuvant now that we've seen the survival data that you just went through that was just presented. So exciting. But I think one of the issues, of course, is how does this translate to practice? We do have an FDA indication. As you mentioned, it's interesting that they use the word high risk. I was going to mention that you were mentioning before we started that Sarah Tulaney's taken over as head of breast there now that Eric Weiner is moving to Yale. And Sarah was on a program we did with Roy Herbst from Yale on his lung and Jeff Weber of melanoma fame. So we were contrasting breast, melanoma, and lung from an adjuvant perspective. And of course, in breast, there's so much going on, not just PARP. You've got IO, Pembro, and of course, abemaciclib and ER positive. So everything's kind of coming together at once, it seems. And one of the themes we were getting into in general with adjuvant and neoadjuvant therapy, I would characterize as lumping versus splitting. And this is something you see a lot in oncology right now, particularly a lot of adjuvant solid tumor trials. People are trying to figure out, should they use the criteria of the trial? Should they use the FDA thing? IOs, there's a big issue about, you have some trials that they just look globally and they saw an advantage, but then look inside the trial, the PD-1 didn't
predict.
Are you going to eliminate them? The FDA in gastroesophageal approved it, even though it didn't show benefit in the subset. So, of course, the subsets are more suspicious, less numbers. So I want to kind of apply that concept to how you view the issue of PARP inhibitors, specifically olaparib, in the neoadjuvant-adjuvant setting, and particularly how you are navigating the FDA indication or situations where you're trying to get around it, particularly the issue of who you treat. And the two big ones from my global point of view is, do you just want to treat germline BRCA, which I guess is the indication, right?
Right, that is.
So theoretically, you can't treat, it's not indicated for somatic, and it's not indicated for other germline, right?
Right.
So the first question would be, if you could, and of course, costs always come in here, but we like usually put that aside and start out with just the clinical risk benefit. Like if it were you and you could do whatever you want, what would you do? So that's my question to you. If you could do whatever you want, when you look at the risks of something like olaparib, would you go beyond germline BRCA if you could right now? And would you go down in risk, like ER positive? Would you do it for two positive nodes or even a big node negative?
Yep.
Let's start with that one.
Good. Just so you start with the easy stuff first.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't worry about the HER2 positive tumors. They have so many drugs and they were not in the study at all. But I think that there are two challenges here. One is the gene, as you pointed out, and the other is how much tumor. So I would be very tempted to want to use a PARP inhibitor for a PALB2 carrier who had a lot of disease based on our data. Now, it is a small number of cases, but it's hard to complain against a zero. There were no non-responders. Now, we have expanded the trial. So we have now a trial in PALB2 only and in somatic BRCA only, 30 each, but it's still very small. And those are metastatic. But I would be tempted in a PALB2. So I'll just say that, not in any other genes right at the moment. And what about how much? So I have to say, when we were planning the trial, this issue of four positive nodes was really complicated. The FDA was so afraid that ER-positive tumors do so well that adding a PARP inhibitor was going to only be toxicity. So it was a relief to show an advantage for both. And we knew there would be one because we'd already seen it in the BRCA2 carriers. So it does make you want to consider high risk based on all your other knowledge of when tumors are high risk. And certainly four or more positive nodes are high risk, but there are other factors that would have made you uncomfortable. I'm afraid we're going to be negotiating with the insurers because these drugs are not inexpensive, but I would certainly be tempted in three positive nodes.
And from a clinical point of view, I mean, I guess just globally, as I look at it, and you know, I'm hearing stuff in every different tumor nowadays, but just trying to macro it out a little bit in terms of this specific issue of who is going to get treated. Of course, the other thing is the toxicity. I mean, we treat people with adjuvant endocrine therapy, have you know, 1 millimeter tumors, because we consider it relatively safe. Globally, when I look at PARP inhibitors, when I look at olaparib, in terms of tolerability, it seems in the realm of endocrine therapy. The thing that gets people nervous, I think, is MDS and AML. And I'm curious where you see that. It looks like in the early setting, we saw this in ovary too, a lot less AML and MDS when you use it earlier. It looks like Olympia doesn't have that much. How much of a concern is it right now?
Well, I think it is a serious worry, but really the data have been more reassuring than we might hope. It's still early days, however. I'm sure you'd agree with that. There is a meta-analysis that really looks quite promising. And we do have to remember that all of the patients, as I said, until now, everybody has had chemo plus PARP inhibitor. All of them. So right. If there's a move toward, let's say, a trial with PARP inhibitor alone in the earlier, less high-risk setting in patients who might be able to avoid or reduce substantially their chemo, you might feel that that was a better model system to be thinking about. But if we're using it in patients who are having chemo, adjuvant, neoadjuvant, et cetera, it is a concern. But so far, it looks pretty good. And remember, in the chemo data, the toxicities at the bone marrow are all seen by 10 years follow-up. So it's the early period where you're looking.
I was really struck by the ovary data because in the advanced setting, the first trials that came out, they saw 8% AML MDS, but they saw 4% in the control group because they had so much chemo.
Right.
And so, of course, again, when they backed it into their adjuvant setting, a lot less. What about these like scores like LOH, HRD? First of all, what are they actually measuring? And at least in ovary, people look at that and try to make decisions. A lot of times docs are doing it in ovary and then they have another patient in breast. They think it's the same thing. Do those kind of measures apply in breast?
Well, I think it's quite likely that they may. So the HRD score, it's just sequencing the tumor and looking to see, is there a lot of evidence of DNA damage unrepaired? And do you see a second mutation in the gene that's abnormal in the germline? So a BRCA1 or BRCA2, whichever. Because those tumors that have lost both copies should be the ones most responsive. And so far they are, but that's not a very big data set. And you asked about LOH, so loss of heterozygosity. Boy, remember when we first started learning about all of this, if you had one mutation in the cell and you lost the normal copy, that was loss of heterozygosity. You'd be left only with the abnormal, and those cells are then abnormal. They can't repair. But there are tumors, we know this actually from our data long ago when we looked at ER-positive breast cancers in our BRCA1 patients, some of them, 20 or 25%, did not lose the second copy, and they did not look like high-grade ER-positive tumors. Most of them still had PR, and their oncotypes would be expected to be low. So you know that there is some variability. Just the germline may not be enough, but it's a pretty good surrogate to start with, certainly in a high-risk population, which is where we have approval now.
So again, kind of getting back to the lumper and splitter idea, and I'm going to make my way towards people who don't have any kind of abnormality, nothing, no mutations, no LOH, et cetera. Because we've seen data, first we saw it in ovary with niraparib, and then we just recently saw it in prostate. It seemed like they saw benefit of PARP inhibitors in people who had nothing that they could identify. Obviously, they're missing something that they're not measuring. This gets into the whole lumping and splitting things. We had a case on a webinar on lung cancer. Patients had a CR for 2 years with PD-1 whose PD-1 level was zero, which is hardly ever happens, but there the patient is.
Right.
Do you want to deprive the patient of a therapy that's not too likely to kill them when they could save their life? I mean, such a challenging time to be in oncology. But I mean, can you envision the idea of using PARP when you don't have anything? I mean, they're thinking about it and even talking about it in prostate and ovary.
I mean, I think ovary is fundamentally different. Ovary biology, even without a mutation, is so much more like BRCA carriers. Their response to platinum, their response to PARP inhibitors. So I think ovary is not a good alternate because it's really different. breast and prostate may be more alike in that way. Maybe we've always thought they were more alike. I don't know that it's the hormones or what. But there have been a number of studies, the early iceberg studies, but before them, where you just could not demonstrate a response to olaparib in people whose tumors did not have a mutation. Karen Gelman's studies in Toronto, it's been much harder. So they may exist. They are rarer. I think that some of these other genes are worth looking at, but the data so far on ATM and CHEK2 are so disappointing. They're much more common than the BRCA mutations, but this doesn't look like it's going to be the answer for them. And I would hate to waste people's time and toxicity on a very expensive drug if its chance of working is very low. Especially, it's like triple negatives. We've got sacituzumab, govitecan. We've got immunotherapies. We don't need PARP inhibitors for them, at least early on.
That's a great point. Yeah, I was just flashing on. I don't know if you know Emmanuel Antonakis. He was at Hopkins. Now he's in Minnesota. He's a prostate person. He says BRCA should have been called PRCA, not BRCA, because he thinks that prostate's more BRCA-like than breast. But anyhow, it's more tied in hereditary-wise. But anyhow, I also was curious. You mentioned one of my favorite studies that I've seen in the last couple of years, which is the Neotala study. I was so shocked when I saw that. You seemed a little disappointed that not everybody responded, but a lot of people have been stunned by the path CR rate of 50%. I'm curious how you can differentiate why you respond versus not in this kind of clean situation you're looking at it. And I don't even know if there's a practical basis to it, although I wonder, I mean, could you envision incorporating PARP inhibitors into neoadjuvant therapy?
I absolutely could see PARP inhibitors in the neoadjuvant space. I think that's going to be one very crowded space for trials. Why not? If you can do it in a way that using other active drugs there, why not PARP inhibitors if they're less toxic? But I think my surprise was that that was not a small group of women in that study who you could not have predicted from looking at their mutations would not respond to the PARP inhibitor. So if that's true, then we're giving PARP inhibitor to a group of women, even in the adjuvant setting, who we already should be able to figure out are not going to benefit, at least give them capecitabine. Don't waste their time again with a drug that doesn't work. But I don't think we can predict at the moment looking at the Neotala cohort which women they are. But I'm sure Jennifer is trying to figure that out because that really is important.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, actually, if you think about it, when you think about targeted therapy, lung cancer, EGFR, 80, 90% of people in a waterfall plot. So it is really interesting that they made that observation. One other thing, you were talking about the issue of prior platinum with Olympia, which I'm not sure I've seen before. I know that question's been out there. What did they see in Olympia? And what do we know in general about responsiveness to PARP inhibitors in people who've had platinums?
So in Olympia, I don't think we have enough yet. At least we haven't subset any of the analysis beyond what was designed in the original study cohort. I'm sure we'll get to it for platinum. In ovary, it hasn't seemed to matter whether patients were or were not platinum. Even platinum-resistant patients have still responded sometimes to PARP inhibitors. In breast, there's been less definitive data. And people have talked about even using, in the old days, platinum responsiveness as a predictor of response to PARP inhibitors. So if you responded, then you could go on and get more PARP inhibitor and avoid more platinum, or if you didn't respond, then maybe not. But I think those data are still a little bit all over the place. And I think people have accused the Olympiad and BRCA trials of cheating a little bit by not allowing the direct comparison to platinum. But I think at the moment, that's probably less critical. Finding a role and working out the timing, should you be trying to use the PARP inhibitor not after platinum, although you really, from Olympia, you have no reason to avoid that platinum up front. And that's important because now you're going to have a whole generation of women who are going to be receiving their Keynote 522 data that includes a platinum. And then what happens if they turn out to be BRCA positive and now you're asking, what do I do with their PARP inhibitor? So we can talk about that in the cases, but I don't know the answer.
That is obviously an extremely common question right now that oncologists are asking.
It certainly
is. I was just kind of flashing. Wasn't there this assay, ERCCA or something, that they used to do for platinum sensitivity? You know what that looked at?
I think in lung cancer.
Yeah.
In lung cancer, those ERCCA, XRCCA, other DNA repair genes in lung that predicted response to platinum, I don't think they ever did so in breast. And they were not very often mutated in breast. But I'm not sure that I have all the data at my fingertips. What I know about it was that they were, in the early days, not helpful.
Right. And of course, it never panned out in lung. But the other thing is that a couple issues with platinum. One, more in the metastatic setting, would be if they progress on a platinum, do you see any benefit from PARP inhibitors? But the other one that's always fascinated me is, for whatever reason, and again, you have the general medical oncology who treats ovary, prostate, and breast. That's why I'm bringing that up, because they hear all this stuff.
Yeah.
So they hear from the gynecologist for a long time, the best way to use PARP is give platinum. If they're responding, then use PARP maintenance. And in the beginning, when we started to present cases, oncologists, that's the way they would answer, because they were used to doing it from ovary. But I don't even think that strategy was ever tested in breast, was it?
Not specifically, although there is PARP maintenance data coming in breast. I think that the one challenge we have is that the PARP data in the metastatic setting is clearly most effective used in the early lines of therapy, first or second. And so it's going to be harder to have a lot of treatment first and bring PARPs in later, unless it's done in a structured way and we can really evaluate it. But I would be cautious about doing that right now. Olympiad and BRCA were first and second line only and really showed their benefits there.
Well, let's get into the cases and start to maybe draw out a little bit more the way you're trying to apply this now, how you think you might want to apply it in the future, where you think things are heading.
So this was a recent new presentation of breast cancer in a 39-year-old with breast cancer, high-grade ER positive, HER2 negative with 3 positive lymph nodes, who turns out to have a BRCA2 variant and had her mastectomies and now is in the middle of her chemo. And the question is, what are we going to do with her after her chemotherapy is complete? So obviously hormonal therapy, since she's ER positive with ovarian suppression and an aromatase inhibitor. But what else? Do we add a PARP inhibitor? Do we add abemaciclib? Do we give them both together?
And I guess I would ask, does this woman fit the indication for olaparib?
So she doesn't quite, does she?
No.
Because she's only got 3 positive
only
lymph
3
nodes.
Positive nodes.
Right.
I mean, can you imagine an oncologist who's in this situation personally, who's got a BRCA? Now, this is germline BRCA2, right?
This is germline BRCA2. It's germline genetic testing.
I mean, can you imagine a medical oncologist who has 3 positive nodes and knows that she's BRCA germline, then it doesn't fit the indication?
So, well, that's why I'm hopeful that what the FDA did by saying high risk and not defining high risk.
So it fits the indication, but not the trial.
It did not fit the trial. So I will have to hope that the insurers are not that specific. But I would say I would certainly still want to give her olaparib. So having talked to some colleagues about this case, this is where I mentioned before that at least in the Monarch E study, abemaciclib could be added later. And since we have no data on the combination, perhaps in this setting, compared to other ER-positive patients, you would give the year of olaparib and then switch to abemaciclib. But that could be wrong. I don't know.
Are there any safety data that exist or are being looked at in terms of combining abema and olaparib?
One of the challenges about this whole thing has been that the trials themselves have been so preferentially triple negative that the amount of data we have on ER positives is really limited. Even in Olympia, only 20% of those cases are ER positive. It's going to be difficult to do a sufficiently powered subset analysis in those patients. And so I think we have to be cautious here, and maybe we'll see more studies now. We certainly have enough patients. Much of the world is preferentially BRCA2 positive, not BRCA1. So maybe there'll be more trials in ER positives now. But so far, really, Neil, the data are limited.
So again, just balancing risks and benefits, and again, putting costs aside, at least for the moment.
Right.
I could say, suppose this lady was node negative. Hazard rate of 0.68 for survival. I mean, if she were node negative with 3.5 centimeter tumor, what would you estimate her risk of recurrence would be?
Oh, that's tough. I mean, I guess you could get some help out of your oncotype for this, but if she were node negative with this, I mean, wouldn't you think about other ways to try to figure out how ER positive is this? It doesn't look like it will be, but then I might use an oncotype to help. Here, the oncotype's going to be high, but you may as well look. But those positive nodes.
Even without the oncotype, if you have a situation, for example, where you think the patient is, let's say, 20 or 25% risk of recurrence. So, quote, sort of low. I mean, not really. But again, looking at the toxicity of PARP inhibitors in that situation and getting the kind of hit you get in terms of relapse rate and survival, would you want to bring that 20 or 25% down to 15%? I don't know for sure you can say you would, but if you thought you could, would you do it?
Well, I think it's very tempting, but I think like we don't really want to abuse this high risk definition. It would be harder with no positive nodes. It's going to make us all struggle about what's in the middle. And it's going to make this a more complicated struggle as these trials in individuals with much less disease really get going. And they should, because maybe all you need is a PARP inhibitor, or you need that PARP inhibitor here, as you point out, in a disease that you can see is going to be a bad actor, even if the nodes are not involved yet. That's a tough question.
So I'm curious what happened with this lady and what her current status is.
So this is a real case, and she is receiving her chemotherapy, and she will receive her ovarian suppression and AI. But I think based on the discussion among us, we sometimes pass the cases around like everybody else does, that I would say she will get olaparib followed by abema.
Olaparib followed by abema. Interesting.
Well, you get it all. I mean, as long as you got good insurance, otherwise you're in big trouble.
But interesting that you start out with the olaparib. I guess you can't compare indirectly, but the hazard rates do look better. You've got survival, good hazard rate. So I guess if you can only choose one to start with, that makes sense.
I just think you have no data for olaparib later.
Right.
And at least you have some data for abema later. So I think it would be tough to reverse the order.
What is your general thought, incidentally, about abema in the BRCA wild-type patient? Are you generally using it, and what situations?
So I am using it more in high-risk situations, but there I've tended to stick closer to the monarchy criteria. I don't know about you. I've tried. I mean, all of these drugs have toxicities. All of these drugs are challenging in their own ways. So
I want to ask you something else that I actually saw a paper on yesterday, which I've been curious about for a while, which is patients with other solid tumors who are BRCA germline and whether or not they respond. We've had lung cancer cases.
Yep.
I mean, obviously you would imagine there are people out there who can get lung cancer, maybe has nothing to do with their BRCA, but what do you do? Do you ever use PARP inhibitors in lung or sarcoma or who knows what?
So people have done compassionate use studies of N of one to see if this works. I mean, I think that's where you're back to asking your HRD question. Should you sequence them and look to see if they have a second mutation? And then you might really want to give it a try. Or if you don't, are you saying maybe we shouldn't, we should try other things first? Some of those tumors are BRCA driven. I don't think we have a complete inventory for all of the cancers related to BRCA. And so I am tempted to try to clarify that. I do think there's plenty of data in pancreas now, in prostate, certainly. So those patients are supposed to get tested so you can see if this is an option for them.
Speaking of testing, I wanted to ask you also, you went through a lot of really interesting data about the incidence of various abnormalities, including BRCA. But the bottom line now, particularly with this update, with the survival data, I'm going to say, who would you not get germline? And I'm going to say NGS. I would assume it'd be a patient you wouldn't give olaparib to, but you might want to know it for later purposes. What's your approach right now, Dana-Farber, in terms of over, you walk through the door, you're getting NGS and germline.
Right.
But whether or not we're ready for that in breast, you tell me.
Well, so I think the NGS I can do first, because the incidence of somatic BRCA, an acquired BRCA mutation in a newly diagnosed breast cancer, is incredibly low. In metastatic disease, however, I think everybody should be tested to see if they've acquired that mutation. And now we have data that in the metastatic setting, this PARP inhibitor might work, and they would never have known otherwise that they were eligible. The germline testing, so we've been pretty open. We, for a while, have tested all of our patients with breast cancer. And I think you can do that. But I actually think that the data from that second analysis of the Mayo Clinic data is pretty compelling. If you just do all women 60 and under, and women 60 and over who have some other risk factor, you will miss a very small percentage of mutation carriers. So that's a pretty easy division, right? Everybody 60 and under, and 60 and over, if you have some family history, some pancreas, prostate, ovary, it doesn't all have to be breast cancer, and you will pick up the vast majority of mutation carriers that way. I think that's a pretty practical approach.
Well, I mean, you said that'll leave you with 2%, and I see like NTRK, which is less than 1%, getting treated. So I don't know. Oncology seems like we're looking more and more for things that are uncommon. So I don't know.
Well, where I live, it's very easy. We have rapid testing programs. We can test everybody. It's pretty inexpensive. Even without insurance coverage, it's only $250.
Wow.
And most people are covered for this, for their genetic testing. So I would personally rather err on the side of testing everyone and missing as little as possible. But you will find things that are just noise, and the patient then has to deal with that as well as all their important data. So you just have to be prepared, if you're going to do that, that you have some help in dealing with those variants of uncertain significance and all that ATM check two stuff that is less critical. That doesn't mean you should know about it, but you will time it differently.
I'm curious how the pandemic and the emergence of telemedicine has affected genetic counseling. I know before the pandemic, I was all like, why don't we have some kind of centralized video thing? And now I think we have more of it, but I'm not really sure what's going on. You tell me. It seems like so logical.
Oh, I mean, genetics is like the perfect place for telemedicine because you don't have to examine people for much of it, because you can arrange the testing, sign a consent form virtually, have a kit sent from the testing lab, send your saliva back, you don't even need blood, and get your results in 2 weeks. So it is a perfect situation for this. The genetic counseling can all be done by telemedicine before or after. However, the insurance companies are making it more complicated again. So during the pandemic, we switched almost completely to virtual testing, and we cleared up all our backlog, and it was great. And now that the pandemic is winding down, the insurance companies don't want us doing anything across state lines. So all of the virtual advantage is disappearing. And my hope is that our patients will say, why is this disappearing? It's much easier for me to get my care in some hybrid form, and don't take away my virtual medicine. Why not? But so far, we're back to challenges.
I mean, I'm a simple person, but basically it seems like it'd be even cost effective, right? I mean, maybe
Absolutely.
Not that's the way it works out, but it seems like incredibly cost effective, not just for genetic counseling, but for a lot of stuff.
For many things.
But you know, one other thing I was curious about, I think you alluded in your talk to the idea of PARP inhibitors as a prevention,
yes.
Which kind of surprised me because I kind of felt like, well, maybe we have that solved with preventive surgery and all and MDS and all that stuff. But what is the deal?
Yeah. Well, I mean, surgery does work, but the timing is always an issue. And many people would prefer not to have preventive surgery. So are there ways we could delay? I don't think anybody would think about taking a PARP inhibitor continuously for any prolonged period. But what if you could give it for a short time and clean out those cells that are early in their transformation and then give it again after a while and do the same thing? Maybe you could do that for a while. It's a different way of thinking about prevention, and it's a challenge. Look, if you give antibiotics that way, you'll breed resistance. So you have to make sure that doesn't happen. But if the drug turns out to be safe, perhaps there is a way to do it in a novel approach, not like the usual, and still reduce the risk of cancer. That would be great. In theory, you could knock out those early breast cells, the ovary cells, the pancreas cells all at the same time.
We haven't talked too much about tolerability issues with PARP inhibitors, particularly in patients with breast cancer. I'm curious, for example, in this woman, when you get to the point that you're about to start the olaparib, what are some of the things you're going to bring up with her? What do you typically do? Do you use preemptive medications for GI issues? How do you deal with anemia? What are your experiences?
So I think the anemia, you know, if people have had a lot of chemo beforehand, you know this is going to be an issue. And we try and prepare for it, but we're not, I mean, what do? We watch for it and we try to stay ahead of it a little bit like we all do when we add additional chemotherapy. It doesn't seem to be more difficult than capecitabine in that way. It's just that you have to prepare people for the possibility that they will have some low blood counts that you have to adjust for. And not only anemia, but more often anemia. I think that people have learned to trust us that we can manage their nausea with the other therapies that they've had, all of that other chemo that they got because they're high risk that we took care of. And here we make available medication and then we adjust. And if you've built up trust with your patients as you do, when you get to this drug, you can be pretty honest that there is a reasonable chance they'll have some nausea and you'll see if they adjust to it, give them the oral medications they've used, and then try to back off if things go well.
Just kind of curious how often you see people just cruising through a PARP inhibitor like nothing, like they're taking a Tylenol.
I would say that's uncommon. Most people at least have to adjust a little bit. This is definitely not Tylenol. But of course, you would say the same thing about almost all the other drugs we give, all those hormonal agents we all thought were no big deal. Really, there's nothing we give that is Tylenol. Some people are lucky. Most people will adjust.
But from a quality of life point of view, is it mainly GI issues?
More nausea. The fatigue, I think, is harder to manage. There's no easy answer to that. So I think the same fatigue, that turns out to be a real challenge for some people.
Something in your talk I thought was real interesting, I want to hear more about, which is the correlation between the type of BRCA or the type of alteration and the type of breast cancer. So like this first case was ER positive BRCA 2, second case triple negative BRCA 1. Is that kind of the usual pattern?
So about 70% of BRCA1 tumors will be triple negative, and about 70% of BRCA2 tumors will be ER positive. Now, why that's true, I don't think we have the remotest idea yet. And about 10 or 20% will be the opposite. So there are BRCA1 ER positive tumors and BRCA2 triple negative tumors. So you can't assume that you can predict the gene just by looking at the tumor type. And there are those HER2 positives, but we're leaving them out of this discussion.
It's interesting that in prostate, they have a lot of BRCA2. What's the breakdown in breast, BRCA1 versus BRCA2 and breast cancer?
Well, so in some parts of the world, there are just more germline BRCA1 carriers. In Asia, for example, more BRCA2. In the US, more BRCA1. Although, if you looked at those population data we showed from the carriers, the most frequent mutation was BRCA2. Not by a lot. But it was. So I guess that fits our predominance of ER-positive disease.
So your second case is one of the most common cases I hear from general oncologists. They don't know what to do. So a patient is getting neoadjuvant therapy for triple-negative disease, has residual disease. So many options. What happened with this lady?
So she got olaparib plus immunotherapy on a protocol, because right now we have a few protocols that are looking at this. And I think that for people who don't have access to a protocol, we have Mediola to show us that they are tolerated together. We don't know whether it's better to give them both together, but it's awfully hard now that there are the KEYNOTE-522 data to not continue your IO therapy if you gave IO and had response up front, but now you have this olaparib. You don't know, should you stop the immunotherapy and give the olaparib and then resume the IO? But that's not according to the protocol either. So I know that a lot of people are giving combination. If it's possible to do it on protocol, at least we'll all learn something. But I've not given capecitabine plus IO for this.
What was this patient's physical exam? It looks like she had pretty extensive disease. And then what happened once you gave her neoadjuvant treatment?
So she had an excellent response, as you can see, but not a complete response. So she did respond enough that you'd want to continue your IO therapy afterward. She was from South Asia who came for treatment.
Okay. You want to go to the next case?
Sure. So this lady was interesting because this is a woman I share with an oncologist in the Midwest who presented at 34 with metastatic disease to bone and lung and was found as part of her original workup here, ER positive, PR negative, HER2 positive. She got surgical stabilization and tamoxifen and gazelarin and had her testing, which showed both a germline PALB2 mutation and an ATM mutation. And I just put it in there because we talked about reversion mutations before, how you might fix a gene so that it could go back to having its PALB2 repaired. But with a big piece missing, that's not going to happen. And the tumor was looked at and it showed the same loss, the same germline mutation, but it showed a second mutation. So now you've lost both copies, which is what you'd expect in these PALB2 tumors. It still showed the ATM mutation and it showed some other things as well. So once she got her ovaries suppressed, her oncologist switched her to letrozole and then added palbociclib, and then eventually, she progressed and they added fulvestrant, and then they switched her to exemestane plus everolimus down the hormone pathway many of us might take, and then took out her ovaries. And they saw that she had tumor in her ovary and was progressing overall. And that's when she actually came to Dana-Farber, and we put her on this TBCRC048 study, olaparib for women with non-BRCA1 and 2 mutations, and she got a year of response. And her lesion was her breast mass that had never been resected, because she had metastatic disease up front, and she had a very good response in the breast and improvement in her pain, and then progressed primarily in bone. And the reason I showed it was because when we stopped the olaparib, she actually went on another trial, this time with an ATR inhibitor. And these are being developed partly for people who become resistant to a PARP inhibitor, because what are we doing with people when they get resistant in the metastatic setting? So one thing you can look for is a trial of these ATR inhibitors. There are several of them, and they are looking at one mechanism of resistance. And she actually responded quite well to that. And today she is on a different kind of clinical trial at Dana-Farber, and in between has had some standard chemotherapy from her oncologist closer to home. So we've worked together to care for her for a long time, but fortunately she has responded, although like everyone else, she has developed resistance to everything too. But I thought she was interesting because she was PALB2.
PALB2, and then this ATR. How long was she on the ATR inhibitor?
She was on that for over a year.
And it's interesting, though, going back to when she got olaparib, in addition to responding, also I see that you noted she had multiple grade 2 toxicities. What happened there?
We had to make it so she could take the drug. If you read through the research nurse notes, she had plenty of fatigue and bowel issues, but she was determined. So we were able to keep her on drug by helping to manage her side effects, which were all annoying, not dangerous, but challenging. You want her to have quality of life.
So any closing comments on what you're looking forward to in terms of the next couple years in this field, some of the trial concepts that are being pursued that you think are exciting, kind of what's coming next?
So I think we should all watch for the efforts to predict better who's going to respond. I mean, obviously, we really need those PARP inhibitor immunotherapy combination studies, and there are many of them that are in progress already. I think that combination PARP inhibitor radiation are also quite interesting, given whether combinations work, and it's been so hard to combine PARP inhibitors with standard chemo. All this DNA damage, you'd think it would work, but they're more toxic, so they're kind of more chemo on their own. And then I think the other place where you really want to see some important trials done is in our efforts to right-size chemotherapy or minimize treatment, where perhaps a PARP inhibitor would allow us to get away from giving standard chemotherapy to some lower-risk patients. Is it a possibility that we could do that and simplify their therapy? And that would be, I think, important on its own and might also take us closer to prevention.
One of the things that sometimes we bring up is the idea of people who are new to the field of oncology, particularly like fellows, that maybe don't realize some of the things that happened not too long ago. And I don't know, for some reason, when you started to talk today, I flashed on this ASCO meeting where Joyce O'Shaughnessy was presenting a phase 3 trial. I think the drug was called Iniparib or something.
Yes, it was.
And it turned out it wasn't even a PARP inhibitor. And like everybody was like, oh, that's it. We'll never see this come into practice. But here we are.
Well, I have to say that the pharmaceutical industry in this case, we thought that all hope was gone. Here we had this beautiful lab data that said it should work. And one trial, we thought this is going to kill it. But there were thoughtful people in companies, and we were like campaigners. We lobbied them, and eventually they relented and did it. And I think today they should be very grateful. They're going to make a lot of money on this drug, and we should be grateful that our patients are going to benefit from it.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it too, did we learn anything there? I mean, why did they think it was a PARP inhibitor? It really wasn't.
Well, they must have thought so because they named it like a PARP inhibitor, right? It ended in IB.
Right.
But I remember at the first meeting that I went to where this was presented, the challenge was that the company was reluctant to share any of their data. You understand that they have proprietary information, but they really would share very little, whereas some of the other drugs were already in important studies in animals or humans in the very early studies. And that drug just had no assurance. And I think what we learned was that you should not jump on and do a phase 3 trial with a drug for which you have very little data. Now, it could have been a home run and we would all be singing a different tune, but it was not very cautious. And I think Joyce, who is an experienced and thoughtful clinical trialist, would say this wasn't her finest hour, but she thought maybe it could work and wouldn't that be great? And it is great. It just wasn't that drug. And fortunately, it didn't kill the field. So I don't blame her at all. I think that she tried, but it didn't work out that way. And yet we made it anyway. So I'm grateful for that.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Garber, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.